curators and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. That's up right after these announcements, so stick around.
Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square, Portland. The first Pan-African Festival features entertainment, African food and clothing, informational booths, panel discussion, and more. The goal beyond that is to celebrate and illuminate the hidden treasures of the Pan-African community in Portland. Again, that's the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square at Southwest Yamhill Street between Broadway and 6th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, my name is Eric Bartels, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO FM 90.7 Community Radio. Today, we are joined by phone from her home in Santa Cruz, California, by the longtime Portland artist and educator Andrea Borsick. Borsick's work has been called lush and bountiful, vivid paintings, sometimes accompanied by or adorned with three-dimensional objects. The iconic exists alongside the satirical, and the human element, while often depicted simply or even whimsically, is at times embedded in seemingly threatening environments. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You were in Portland recently. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was visiting and teaching. I have been teaching every summer at the Oregon College of Art and Craft, mixed media classes. I just found out it's been 16 years since I've been teaching there. So every year I do a different take on mixed media or monoprint, and I have students, some of whom have worked with me for 16 years, have come back, some that pop in and back out, and it's been really wonderful teaching there. I love that school.
In preparing for the workshops here every year, does it give you a chance to revisit where you are as an artist?
Well, yeah, it changes. My approach to teaching seems to grow as I grow as an artist. So I think it is reflected in my teaching. I become more clear about the necessity for the way I'm teaching, and it reflects what I'm doing in my studio for sure.
People who knew you from your years in Portland as an artist, what would surprise them about the work you're doing now?
That's a great question. It's maybe less explicitly sexual and subversive. I think when I was working on it, they were early feminist paintings, and I was exploring my own edge. And now they're kind of more sentimental. So maybe that would surprise them, is what a sentimentalist I've become.
We talked off air about how that reflects the journey you've made personally. You obviously were younger, and your life perhaps a little less complex. You're a parent of two grown daughters?
That's correct.
And you talked about how that, your work, logically perhaps, reflects the change in your life experience. Where are you now?
Yeah, where I am now is reading the paper a lot more, paying attention to current events. And I think it's reflected in the work. I think that I'm seeing that everything is just boils down to our connections with people and love and tragedies, these inevitable tragedies that are that happen in our own personal life, things I'm afraid of happening, fear that we all have as life continues. And so I wonder, wow, you know, what's going to happen next? And so I think that my work reflects that, the reality of how much we depend on each other for consolation and just getting through life.
What about the art itself? As an artist, on the one hand, there's your evolution as a person. What do you learn as you go along about how what's inside you comes out or is reflected in your work? Or do you make accommodations as an artist to reflect what you're feeling and thinking?
You know, I think I'm not even aware of it. I think what happens is I follow my gut, and oftentimes I'll be doing something in the studio and I won't really even know why I'm doing it. I've just, something's led me there. It's very unconscious. And then I realize, you know, kind of at times either just talking to somebody about my work or just looking at it late at night or just reflecting on a body of work that, wow, that was so much about this time and what was happening, that it is kind of diaristic. The work that I'm making right now is certainly diaristic.
Over the years, critics who review your work, so common to hear them describe it as very, very rich and very, very complex. Is that a fair description? And B, does it reflect the kind of person you are or what's inside you?
I hope so. You know, rich and complex is a wonderful description. I would take that in a second. I think that they're usually kind of gaudy or overdone because they reflect all things beautiful. I've always said that, you know, that we all have different definitions of beauty, and I've certainly stayed true to that ultimately I want to make what in my definition of beauty might be called, you know, decorative, but also very, very complex and deep, that I can take images that might be hard to look at and balance them in a gorgeous cameo, you know, or next I can make chains of horseshoes and dice and rabbit's feet and lucky eight balls and things that you wouldn't normally think of as beautiful, but the way I put them together, I'm trying to make something that looks like a gorgeous necklace. That's continued through the work that I've done since I was in Portland, only I've changed out some of the objects, and these are much more about our need for luck and prayer, I guess, in some sense.
What was the origin of that? Does it go all the way back? Was there a time when you painted without thinking about these other objects that might be part of the work you were doing?
Well, I think when I was working in Portland, I was using lots of images of women, and I was doing kind of an anthropological or sociological survey of images of beauty, in particular images and definitions of beauty, questioning portrayals of women in art and in culture. And I was trying to figure out how to link these really disparate images of women, and the inevitable solution was to use chains and links on chains and turn them into beautiful jewelry, thinking about the link of history through time and how we're all sort of connected, this story of the link to history, to our long history of representation of women in the arts. And then part of the jewelry, it became more elaborate the more I started to add memento mori, these symbols and these talismans against things that were representative of beauty or of death or of the fact that we're here for a limited time. And then the jewelry started to change. The things that I started to add in the paintings and around the paintings were objects that were very, you know, symbolic and representative of the precariousness of life.
As you went along and became a mother and were raising your two daughters, did that sort of interest fall away, or did it become incorporated in the new experience of being a parent and having someone that you love in such a different way?
Maybe. You know, I think that as my daughters were growing up, I was questioning notions of beauty, you know, as to having two young daughters and thinking about what they were looking at and how they were being educated. And about sexuality, my own, and, you know, as a young mother, and what does that mean, you know, having young daughters and all the messages that they were getting. So I was painting about that. And then, yeah, as they started to grow up and as I started to mature as an artist and pay attention to things in the media, that it changed because the news was changing, things were changing, and that just doing images of women wasn't my interest anymore. I started to look around, and the thing that really got to me were images of tragedies that were happening and how all these images in the newspaper were of people hugging and holding each other after tragedies again and again, and I became fixated on that, about our need for consolation and how what was happening around me really was even as important as femininity and beauty and women's rights. And there were other things. There were other, you know, more political images and really the aging human body. So I was really looking at images of all different stages in life. And that became kind of a pivotal moment for me.
It's about mortality, that as naturally we get older, it's not something we have to think about when we're younger. Is it? Do you think it was as much that as what you were seeing in the news around you, or was it a sort of perfect mix of the two?
I think it really was the perfect mix of the two. You know, the pivotal moment came maybe around Katrina, when the weather was such a reflection of how precarious it was. You know, your location, where you were, if tragedy would happen, if you happened to be in the wrong spot, then you would become a victim, of all these, you know, moments wherever you are. And I guess, sure, you know, we're all worried about what's going to happen when the next shoe's going to drop. So I think weather, you know, when the weather started to change, I guess global warming, that we became vulnerable. And I think as a parent, things do seem more vulnerable and precarious. You realize that your life is more valued. You've got these children that are dependent on you, and then your parents, and you see your parents getting older, and you're constantly straddling this line between you know, what's important, and our own aging process, and how anything can happen at any time, whether it's a hurricane or health issues, cancer, whatever it is.
Now, Andrea, are you a worrier? Are you a person who...
Not at all. That's the weirdest thing. I think maybe that would be the thing that would surprise my friends the most, is that I'm really not a worrier. I'm very seemingly carefree. And, yeah, and I guess that's why this stuff is so unconscious, that my work is really working it out for me, because on the outside, I'm probably one of the happiest people you've ever met.
What has been the response? I mean, in a very general way, what do you hear from people, about the, we at the top of the show, we talked about these sort of looming environments, these menacing environments in which these people find themselves in a lot of your work. What comes back to you from people who look at your work?
Well, in my mother, a recent show, I had drawn maybe 300 little drawings of people in every type of situation I could find, everything from getting a breast exam to protesting young people to dancing people to praying people, all of humanity I was trying to capture, moments, really high points and then really low points and then innocuous moments. And I had these little paintings, little drawings of all these people, hundreds of people arranged on top of a running landscape that was painted directly on the wall. And the reaction that I got from people, I had people come up and they were crying. And they said, "You've really captured it. There's something incredibly touching about all the people." Because the one drawing that I kept coming back to that I drew more than anything else was people hugging each other. And I think that that's really what this is about. It's about our need for humanity and our need to connect. And so I think I touched a lot of people because there was something for everybody. I'm trying to grasp all these different stages in life. How do I, and how I select them, how I select these images of different people going through life. Pivotal moments, really great moments, and then really sad moments, and then sometimes they're sitting on a toilet. And I think people are touched because they are capturing some sense of humanity.
They recognize themselves in it. When you depict something as simple as a person going about his or her everyday business, people are going to recognize that or recognize themselves in that.
Yeah.
We've had artists on the show who are closely involved in social justice issues of one kind or another, and we often have discussions about the role of the artist in whatever the sort of issues of the day happen to be. But I wonder, listening to you, if the artist doesn't just do what he or she does, and the chips just sort of fall where they do, that if your concern is this, if it's feminism earlier in your career or the precarious nature of life at some later point, it's the artist's job is simply to express what he or she is feeling and let that sort of fall however it does on the audience. Does that make sense?
Totally. I think that we're the barometer of what's happening, that I'm just picking up what I'm thinking about, what's going on in my life. And I'm trying to remain as true as I can to what I think is interesting, what I think is interesting for me. And it happens to be very sentimental. But it is also political, because I'm certainly reading the paper every day, and I'm certainly aware and sensitive to what's happening and how I can represent this time. That's what I'm really interested in. You know, whether you're an old person at this time, or older person, whether you're a baby at this time, or whether you're a teenager, what would be the things that they would be doing to represent this? Because ultimately, I really do want these paintings to reflect this time in my life, first of all. And then if it talks to people, to other people, that's great.
You've been teaching for a long time. You taught at Portland State University. You taught at Lewis and Clark, in addition to, as you mentioned, the Oregon College of Art and Craft, which you are still affiliated with. What do you tell students about their voice and how to go about finding it?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's been great is since I've been in Santa Cruz, I've been working at a community college. And very often I'll have classes with 18-year-olds and 85-year-olds. They're all in the same class. And I find that my connection to all these ages is just encouraging people to stay true to who they are, what they define as beautiful or interesting or ugly. And I think the message is that we all come to this point with experiences. Very often the 80-year-olds have a lot more experiences than the younger ones, but that everybody has a point of view and everybody should trust what they're interested in. You know, it's an eaty, meeny, miny, mo kind of situation. Point your finger at what's the first thing that you're interested in. Now go with it. And then it's about form and formal qualities. So I teach kind of an intuitive approach, which is don't question things too much. Just go for it. Just take something, imagery or even shapes, whatever forms, whatever things you're connected to. And then there's a structure to everything I teach too. So there's a lot of form and formalism as well. So if anything, I can get people to lose fear. And I think that's what people like about taking the classes, is that they learn to trust their own intuition, and they learn to trust process, and that it is a lot that's process based, because art making is incredibly fun and challenging, and it engages all your senses, decision making and sensuality, the sensuality of the medium. And to get lost into sort of a meditative journey of working. And mixed media is so wonderful because you're taking disparate objects and putting them together, and you come up with the story by the nature that you picked, maybe a certain picture or a certain design or pattern. You picked it, and you get to work with it, and it's a matter of how to put it all together.
As an art educator, you should be able to tell us, does a person improve technique and then get to the things he or she wants to say? Or do you find the voice and then use the technical proficiency to sort of clarify it? Everyone has a voice. What do you do with that as a teacher?
Yeah, I have a great time with that. I prefer people who haven't had a lot of experience. And part of it is that we all have a voice, that we all like things and dislike certain things, and that's where it starts. What do you like? That's always the question I ask. And exposure to material certainly helps, but you got to start from somewhere. And skills, certainly, you know, the more you do, the more proficient you become. I think that I've worked with, you know, a lot of people in their later years, 60s, 70s, 80s, who maybe didn't ever pick up a paintbrush or do collage or do any kind of system-based drawings where you're getting lost in the process. And I'm amazed that everybody can take to it, and they become kind of addicted to it. And it really is just about the ability to stop questioning and comparing. We are such a society full of comparisons. Is somebody next to me better than I am? And I really try to make my classes not about comparisons. It's just about you being exposed to a kind of open-ended process of making something and discovering yourself in the process. So I think people keep coming back to it because they learn something about themselves each time they work with me. And I think, you know, I teach drawing classes and I teach painting classes, and they can learn about technical things as well. But I think, you know, mixed media classes and a lot of the classes that I do teach, especially at Oregon College of Art and Craft, and some private classes, and even at the college where I teach mixed media, it really does allow people to have a real process-based experience that that is kind of like a journey. They don't know where it's going to end, and I teach them not to worry about where it's going to end. Just follow it along, and you'll see.
Well said. Should everyone make art?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, little kids, starting with, you know, 2 and 3 year old, all the way to 85. I have a father who's 88 years old, and he is at the most prolific time in his life making the most beautiful sculptures I've ever seen. So, yes, everybody should make art. It makes you feel better about life. It's the antidote to all the stuff that's happening around us. Just take an art class, and it really is a way to get outside of your head and inside your head.
I feel like I don't even have to ask the next question. What kind of a world would we be living in if everyone could and did make art? How would it look different?
I think we'd have people who are a lot happier. I think people need time to create and need time to make. We are makers by nature. If you think about just children going to the beach, their first impulse is to make something out of the sand. Or if you give them a crayon, instantly, they don't think about it. They just start drawing. And somewhere we've stopped doing that right around the age of 11. And our education system has not helped that. So if you haven't been able to take a class when you were young, you probably never took, you never learned that yellow and blue make green.
Right.
And so not everybody's, you know, our education system has definitely not supported the arts. And it's never too late. And I really do want to say, if you've never taken an art class before, it's a really great thing to do, because it will be a life changer.
Andrea, thank you so much for being on the show. Our guest today has been Andrea Morsik, a Santa Cruz-based painter and artist who spent many years here in Portland as both an artist and educator. Andrea, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you, Eric.
You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO FM 90.7 Community Radio.